Cool. Welcome, everyone. Today we are having our first Meet the Professional interview with Rob Richardson. He has his Bachelor's of Science in Environmental Sciences from Oregon State University. He did his Master's degree in Geomorphology from Northern Arizona State University, and he is one of the principals and owners of Rio ASE, and they specialize in geomorphic assessments and river restoration design. And this is first in the series of Meet the Professionals for the Idaho section of the American Water Resources Association. And the American Water Resources Association is dedicated to the advancement of water resources management, research, and education. Our members represent a community of water professionals with diverse backgrounds, but we all share engagement in solving some of the toughest water resource challenges. And so until we can meet in person again, you can stay in touch at awraidaho.org. We've got a calendar of events. We'll be releasing recorded webinars and a variety of other recordings online. And we just want to say thank you to all of our sponsors and our members, namely Avista Corporation, Brown & Caldwell, Haley & Aldrich, HDR, and Jacobs Engineering Group. So, Rob. What got you into geomorphology, river restoration, you know, environmental sciences?
Well, thanks for having me, by the way, Kendra. This is great. I've done several of these in person, so this will be my first foyer into the virtual world of meet and greet. But yeah, what got me into river restoration and geomorphology and all that? Well, river restoration first. When I was a kid, my dad, we still have this little cabin up in North Idaho. And so I wanted an excuse to spend more time up there. And my dad helped me finagle a job with the Forest Service as a hydrology technician. And I didn't know what any of that was. I just knew I got to walk around outside all day. Anyway, so I got to do these little mini restoration jobs associated with removing culverts and trying to fix some of the sediment issues up at the streams in North Idaho. So that was really interesting to me, and I wanted to learn more. So I started studying engineering in school and really didn't like civil engineering when I had to start learning about concrete and wastewater. And so I just absolutely bailed on the whole thing. I said, this isn't for me. I stumbled into some geology coursework after I'd actually graduated. I was going to be a teacher. So when I finished my degree, I went to school in Montana for a year to get my teaching certificate and started taking geology classes. And that's where I even learned what the word geomorphology was. I didn't even know what that was back in, you know, 1998, 99. So I started taking these classes, and my professors convinced me to go to grad school, and it just fit like a glove. It was really a good fit for me. I enjoyed it a lot and decided I wanted to get back into it. And that was how it all started, I guess. When I finished, I started off in consulting and just went from there.
Cool.
So good luck, a little bit of just kind of knowing what I wanted to do from the time I was young.
Yeah, so when were you doing the hydrotech stuff?
Let's see, in the early and mid-90s, I started when I was actually 16, in what that would have been 1993. And it was through a state Job Corps program. I couldn't work for the federal government yet because I wasn't old enough.
Yeah.
And so then when I was 18, I got hired officially and worked for six summers after that, all through college and grad school.
Cool. That's an awesome way to string together some college work.
It was great.
I didn't even know that you could work for the GS. Or did you say it was the Forest Service?
It was the Forest Service, yeah.
Yeah, I didn't know that there were jobs through Job Corps that you could do before you were 18. That's awesome.
Yeah, this Job Corps thing, I don't really know all the details about it. It was offered through the state. And so there were a bunch of different options you could pick from, and the Forest Service essentially volunteered to do one. It was more of like a job shadowing. You can go do a bunch of different things, and one of them was for the Forest Service. So I selected that and just got to do a bunch of random things for the Forest Service. And one of them was going out in the field with their hydrology technician at that time. And I liked that. I thought that was really enjoyable, and got to meet the district hydrologist and get to know her quite a bit. And so anyway, we developed a relationship. So once I could actually get hired at the official age of 18, she picked me up and worked for her for six summers. It was great.
Yeah, that's awesome. Super cool. We'll have to, I'll find some links on where that is. If it's still a thing, we'll have to add it to the website.
Yeah, sure.
So What do you do on a typical day? As typical as typical days can be right now.
Yeah, let's talk about a typical day pre-coronavirus maybe, because that might be more beneficial to the people listening, as you know what I've done today since we talked earlier. One of the reasons I like consulting is that I do something different almost every day. And that really suits me. I know some people are a little bit different. They like to be a lot more focused. I'm complacent if I have to do the same thing for too long. And I start losing interest. I stay motivated by doing lots of different things. So on my typical day, I will respond to some emails that are urgent. I'll work on writing a report. I'll do some analysis, either in GIS or a spreadsheet, evaluating some conditions at a project site. I'll do some research, digging into journal articles or agency documents, trying to figure out, has anybody done this before? Is there any information about this site that I'm not aware of? What's the geological story in this particular area? Because in general, as a geomorphologist in a consulting firm, people hire me in particular to try to understand what's going on at this site. How did it get to be the way that it is? What did it used to look like? And what might it look like in the future if we do nothing or if we do some proposed action? So that's generally what I'm trying to figure out. So we have to put all the puzzle pieces together to understand, what makes this certain area tick, this certain river function the way that it does, and what's it going to do if you start messing with some of the variables in the equation.
Yeah, for sure. It sounds familiar to how I feel about my job too.
Good.
The variability is really nice.
Yeah, variability is nice, but I definitely met some people and worked with some people in consulting that they're just not cut out for it. And I think nothing against, it's not saying that's something wrong. I think consulting is just, especially with a really small company like ours, there's only 8 people in our company. And so you end up having to wear a lot of different hats. And some people really like to specialize and focus. And that's hard to do, at least in our company. I think bigger companies and agencies, you have more ability to focus. And I like being, 30,000 feet high rather than, putting my face right down on the ground.
Yeah. So one of the things that it made me think of is, I think as we gain experience in our careers, we get particularly good at problem solving and figuring out how to fill gaps. But I wonder if you were to think back to your younger self, when you came across challenges in school or maybe early in your career, did you have any tips or tricks or ways that you were able to help get yourself to, move past those challenges or find, figure your way through to the answer of something challenging?
I'm definitely going to caveat this by saying it's probably not the right answer, because I'm one of those people that, given the opportunity, I will reinvent the wheel rather than just going with whatever stock wheel is made available to me, for better or worse, and often for worse. I like to look at things and, I'll dig into something, and if it's easy, you just go with it. And if it proves to be challenging, you end up digging in a little bit and spending some time and realizing, gosh, I don't know if I'm on the right track. And I think the really important thing is realizing that any time you've spent working on something is sunk time. You're not going to get that back. So don't waste your time mulling over it. And don't commit yourself just because you've spent time on a certain path. My favorite questions I like to ask myself as I'm moving through a question is, knowing what I know now, how would I start this all over again? And sometimes that's what it actually takes doing, is starting all over again. Other times you realize, all I have to do is take a couple steps back and move forward down this new path. And it's all of a sudden becomes clear. Yeah. But I think one of the keys in science in general is that rarely do you go down the right path from the get-go. There's not often a map that tells you exactly where to go. And so you have to be prepared and expect to take some wrong turns, and that's not failure or doing it wrong or even inefficiency. That's just how it works. And so you just have to ask yourself periodically, especially when you find that you're stuck, knowing what I know now, how would I do this differently? And just go about it and say, okay, here we go. We're going to go off in this new direction now. Anyway, that works for me.
Yeah. I think that would probably resonate with a lot of graduate students or people who have been through those kind of programs, because yeah, you never know the answer at the outset or the path to get to the answer.
Yeah. And I think along those lines though too, some people would say, well, don't bias yourself by trying to figure out the answer beforehand. I think that's probably not correct. I think you should always have a hypothesis that you're working to try to prove. You just have to allow yourself to change your hypothesis as you learn more. And on the flip side, you shouldn't just set forward with one answer and say, okay, I'm going to prove this right no matter what, because that's obviously wrong too. So you just have to be flexible in letting the science, the data, and the information lead the way, and understand how deep your resources will allow you to go. Sometimes your ability to answer the question, the level of detail is dependent on, you know, the amount of time or resources you have to put toward it. And so as long as that's clear between you and your client or you and whoever you're working with, say, okay, well, I'm going to answer it at this level of detail, not that other level of detail. And I think that's okay too. And you just have to remember what level of detail you're striving for, and don't get stuck down a rabbit hole or two.
Yeah, totally. I wonder, this might be a little bit in the weeds, but you know, it's certainly an important part of consulting, and increasingly it's important for me as a research faculty, but how do you build in that kind of time when you're scoping out how much time it's going to take for a consulting project?
That's really hard. And it really, I think the short answer is just experience. I think, you know, lean on, especially at a consulting firm, you can lean on the more senior people who've been doing it longer. I think it's really important for every project to scope your work. And then you can realize when that project is done, if you ought to be tracking your time against that scoped work. So when the project is done, you can evaluate where you went over and where you didn't go under, or where you didn't go over. And then as you start to accumulate, you know, tens or dozens or scores of projects, you can look back, and ideally you've learned after each one of these that, oh, I keep underestimating this or overestimating that. And so you start to hone it in. I think it's those people that just shoot from the hip the whole time and never write any of it down that are bound to repeat the same mistakes over and over and underestimate and overestimate the same things. But that's what really works for me. And frankly, when I scope a project, I tend to do it at least two different ways. I'll take, you know, like any complex problem, I'll break it down into a bunch of smaller pieces in a work breakdown structure. And it's a lot easier to figure out how much effort it's going to take to develop a, you know, a two-dimensional hydraulic model for existing condition versus how much is it going to take to do this whole project.
Yeah.
And so I can break down all those steps and fill out how many hours it should take whichever resource, whichever staff person to do all of that, and then add it all up. Meanwhile, I'll also think in the back of my head, what's my gut telling me? How long should this take to do? And then usually I'll have somebody else go through a similar effort. So we have three different answers at the end of the day. And if they're all pretty similar, we can feel confident in our guess for whatever that scope is. And if they're all really different, then we know we need to sharpen our pencils a little bit and dig in a little bit more.
Yeah.
But I've worked with a lot of people who just say, oh, that's a $40,000 project, bam, and that's it. And some people can do it, and I don't know how often they screw it up, but that's not me.
Yeah. I just recently, in the past year, started using a time tracker myself. There's a bunch of free ones online. And yeah. I haven't accrued enough project hours on the different things to like really dig into it, but I think that it'll be really valuable for me down the road as I continue to scope things out. It's a really good way. And breaking it down into those little pieces. I find myself with grad students, they're like, I need to defend my PhD. And it's like, there are so many steps before there. Because when you look at that big high level project goal, you're, you know, it's like, you're not going to get anything done.
It's daunting.
Yeah.
But I mean, I have a certificate or whatever it's called as a project management professional. And I think that's been really valuable, especially I think as a geomorphologist, because the geomorphologist on the project is often sort of looking at the project and staying up at 30,000 feet to make sure that sort of the overarching design of a restoration project is still meeting the intent of the project goals and is still sort of functioning within the geomorphic realms of that particular project site. And so being at that 30,000 feet, it's I think well suited for me to be a project manager as well, because I'm kind of keeping tabs on everything that's happening from up at 30,000 feet. And so one of the foundations in project management, of course, is developing your scope of work and how to build a work breakdown structure and how to track your time and compare, you know, the variance of your actual accrued time versus what you budgeted, so you can see when you're off track early instead of after it's already happened. And anyway, it's I think project management training is super helpful.
Where did you do yours at?
This is the Project Management Institute, PMI. They're the only organization that I'm aware of that offers a certification in project management. And it's challenging. I mean, it's putting a bunch of words to kind of common sense, so it can be a little bit annoying, the, you know, taking the test and learning, but there's actually a lot of really valuable information in there. And whether it's, you know, you're getting a certificate or not, you know, I think just learning how to build a good work breakdown structure, and not just building it from scratch, but actually figuring out, well, what are the goals and objectives of a project beforehand? And then leveraging those to figure out, well, how do we accomplish each one of these goals and objectives? And then those actions to accomplish the goals and objectives are the things from which you build your scope of work, all of your tasks and subtasks. But they always need to be driven by the goals and objectives of the project, rather than just, you know, what I think the project should be, because our stakeholders might have a different idea. And so that's really helpful in kind of learning how all of that fits together in a project management world. And that really helps with organizing a project and keeping it moving forward and scoping it correctly and applying the right amount of time and the right resources.
Did you do that after you were done with grad school? Oh. Like once you already started consulting?
Yeah, quite a ways after. You know, when I was consulting at first, like you'd imagine, I was just working on other people's projects as a, you know, a staff person. And so they would have scope. They would just tell me, you have 12 hours to do this particular thing, or you have 40 hours to do this thing. And as I got moving forward, you know, several years later, I started managing my own projects where I had to build my own scopes. And so I used some templates that people had, and I slowly kind of created my own. And it's just in Excel, but it, you know, it's a series of tabs in an Excel spreadsheet, kind of filling in what the project is, goals and objectives, who's involved. And then you start to identify what all the tasks are, and all the tasks are listed down as rows, and all the resources, the people, are columns, and you just fill in hours for each one, and it adds it all up, and you can track against it. But it's been an organic growth. And then once I was probably 12, 15 years in before I actually took any formal training. And then after a couple of years of training and took the test to get my certification.
Yeah. I think it's an interesting thing. Leho and I have talked about this quite a bit. Same thing with when you move from a graduate position into a PI position, or, you know, any scenario where you're managing other people. And in grad school, you don't learn. I mean, you might have people working with you or for you, but you don't actually learn any specific skills about project management. And it's something that we all inherently end up doing. And so I think, you know, thinking through what those options look like for gaining some of those skills or learning from mentors or whatnot, it seems like a really valuable thing for a lot of students. Yeah, I wonder, have you had any mentors in any of your previous positions that, you know, were either really helpful or, you know, like something, or you're like, seek out somebody that can mentor you in this thing?
Yes and no. I mean, certainly through school, I had a couple of really invaluable mentors, and they were more, you know, inspiring than true mentors. You know, they encouraged me and just showed me the path, you know. And then once I got to work in consulting and in my career, I wouldn't say I had an individual mentor. It was almost more like, I'm going to use an analogy here, but it's kind of like in river restoration, you know, you try to look for this mythical reference condition to model your design after it. And they don't exist, right? There is no reference condition for what you're trying to build, because every stream is a little bit unique, and pretty much every stream is impacted and has unique constraints and all this stuff. But what we end up doing is going out into the field and, you know, even just looking at data online or researching, you know, journal articles or whatever the case may be, and you find, you piece together your reference from all of the available information. And I guess I sort of did the same thing from a mentorship perspective. You know, early on, my first, you know, sort of real geomorph job after a couple of years consulting in geotechnical world, which I didn't really enjoy, but was my foot into the door. I was working for a geomorphologist in Seattle, and she was great. I loved working with her, but she had her quirks and things that I decided were really frustrating for me, but she was really talented and very good at these other things. So I tried very hard just to emulate the things that I thought that she did well that I liked, and sort of try to bypass the things that annoyed me. And then, you know, I met other people, and then you meet, you know, you pick up the things that you really like that people do, and realize too that you kind of have to fit it to who you are. You know, I'm not a researcher. I'm a terrible researcher. But as far as like trying to figure out what's going on at a project site, you know, I'm pretty good at just sitting down at a project site and saying, okay, well, here's what's going on, big picture.
Yeah. I think that's really valuable advice to think about, not putting all your eggs in one basket when it comes to mentors, because I can, like, remembering back, I can remember that there was a couple of faculty that I was like, oh my gosh, I want to be just like you. But then after I got to know them, I was like, no, I don't. But I think the real big point there is like figuring out what works for you and being able to identify that and like kludge it together from a lot of different mentors is really valuable.
Yeah, I think it's so rare that you're going to find somebody so much like you that is doing exactly what you want to do, that finding a single mentor is going to be challenging. And or you find a mentor for now and then you move on, you get a new mentor later, whatever the case. But frankly, anybody in your life can be your mentor, whether it's official or not, if it's just how much you're willing to pick up that, you know, they're putting down for you.
Yeah, for sure. So now that we're in COVID times, this is the fun one. Do you have any motivational ideas or do's or don'ts for working at home?
Yeah, don't start a kindergarten in your house like we are. That's number one. there's lots of don'ts, and I won't go into those for real. Do start a kindergarten. It's actually going to be really valuable for my daughter compared to the alternatives. But the do's for me, and again, this is totally related to me. The hardest thing for me to do is get started. Once I get started in something, I can totally knuckle down and just go for broke. But it's really hard for me to get started. And so I need to provide a little bit of regimen to my day. I need to tell myself I'm going to get up and exercise, and I'm going to be at my desk at 8 o'clock. And then I'm going to not go out and water the garden and go, you know, weasel in on my daughter's little lesson to hear what she's doing until lunchtime. Yeah. But I think working from home, especially with family and all the distractions, it's really just, you know, headphones. These things are super important for me. I can put those on with classical music just to drown everything out and focus. That's really important for me. And I think sometimes you have to work late and that's just the way it is. But I think some people can get in the trap of just working endlessly too, because you're never more than 20 feet away from your computer. So yeah. I think just be cognizant of that. And I don't know. I honestly don't feel like I'm doing as well as probably a lot of other people out there. It's been really challenging. And I guess maybe that's the last part, is that everybody's struggling with this right now. And as we had, you know, we had a board meeting the other day, and the other two owners of my company, we were just all commiserating about how hard it is to stay motivated right now, how inefficient we feel like we're working. And I just think that's kind of par for the course. And, you know, misery loves company. Call up your friends, call up your colleagues, and just talk. I get in my little bubble of just working. And I think we need to keep reminding each other to do stuff like this, talk to other people, get on the phone. Don't just knuckle down and try to work all day long. Like, get out and actually talk to people, even if it's virtually.
Yeah, totally. I would agree. Commiserating with colleagues is huge. And it's also, you know, if you were in your traditional work environment, you would be interacting with them normally throughout the day, rather than actually like sitting at your desk for 8 hours straight and not interacting with other humans. So figuring out a way to incorporate it at some. And I think the hardest one for me has just been like brainstorming stuff, because I really like being able to write on a board. And I know there's the digital whiteboard on Zoom, but I don't
know. Not the same.
I can't write on that thing.
Yeah, I'm with you. I miss our giant whiteboard. I miss just, our office, everybody's in the same room. And so we can all just turn around and holler at somebody. And I'm the king of interrupting everybody in our office. So they're all probably more productive now that I'm not there. But it is challenging. And I think you just have to remember that and try to be proactive about it. And it does really help. You know, I'm sitting in my bedroom, but I can shut the door and I can isolate myself a little bit. And so when I really, and then put on my headphones if I really need to isolate. And that sends a message to everybody. When my daughter opens the door and she sees I have my headphones on, she knows to turn around.
Yeah, totally. Nice. Well, this is so great. I'm so glad that we got to chat, and I'm really excited to be doing more of these in the next couple of months. So if you know anybody else that wants to do an interview, we'll probably be trying to do one like once a month or something.
Yeah, absolutely. And let me know if you need or want any follow-ups. If people have questions for me specifically, you can send them my email address.
Okay. Yeah, that'd be great.
Cool.